I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, attacks kill 50 in Iraq. The U.S. does not oppose Britain or France arming Syrian rebels.
The longer the bloodshed goes on, the greater the prospect that the institutions of the state of Syria implode.
Mixed views in Iraq on the 10th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion. And President Obama is setting off for the Middle East. It's all ahead. Iraqi officials say bombings and other attacks have killed at least 50 people and wounded 200 others in mainly Shiite areas of the capital, Baghdad. VOA correspondent Scott Bobb is in the city.
The attacks were all over Baghdad. They seem to have occurred primarily in Shiite-dominated areas. The targets were mostly civilian, although there were some attacks near government buildings and one near the Green Zone that houses a number of embassies, including the U.S. Embassy and government ministries. The attacks were mostly car bombs that were detonated by remote, which were not suicide bombings, although there was one reported suicide bombing. The suicide bombings tend to be the signature of the al-Qaeda-related Islamist extremist groups, whereas the detonated bombings, and this is a broad generalization, often are by resistance groups that are opposed to the government of the Iraqi president.
Our correspondent says the upsurge in violence has tied up Baghdad.
It's very difficult to move around the city because there's tight security. In addition to the hundreds of checkpoints, which are now at a crawling pace because of the intense scrutiny being by the security forces, there are actually a lot of mobile security points that have been erected. Tremendous traffic jams, and a lot of people aren't going out. It can take 2 hours to go just from one district or to a neighboring district. So it's very limited, and it may be like that for a couple of days.
The violence today comes on the 10th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion that toppled the government of Iraq's then-president Saddam Hussein. Although some Iraqis say life since then has improved somewhat, many are angry at the legacy left by the war. Correspondent Scott Bobb, earlier in Baghdad, filed this report for VOA television.
Early morning in central Baghdad's Batawin district. Out-of-work laborers huddle on the street hoping to pick up a day's wages. Abed Khaled is a house painter. He's been coming here for 10 years. He says he works a few days a month. It earns him about $35 a day.
Everybody is suffering. There are no jobs. When an employer comes by, everyone rushes him, competing to get hired. The income is very little. It's bad, and every day seems to get worse.
Baghdad's streets are choked with vehicles as workers head to their jobs. Tight security slows traffic even more. Most residents say life is hard. Only a few seem to have benefited from the conflict that took more than 100,000 lives and continues to do so today in reduced numbers. In a central market a few kilometers away, Najila Ali Saba shops for her 9 children and 21 grandchildren. She says bombs are a major worry.
Life is difficult because of the security situation, the terrorists. Most of the terrorists are not Iraqis. They are coming from foreign countries.
10 years ago, U.S.-led forces launched the airstrikes and subsequent ground invasion that brought an end to the regime of President Saddam Hussein. But most Iraqis say the system that replaced him has not fulfilled their hopes for freedom or democracy. They are especially angry at their politicians. They accuse them of widespread corruption and stoking ethnic and sectarian tensions to further their careers. Hadi Jalo Mare heads Baghdad's Center for Political Analysis.
There are deep divisions among the Iraqis. Some Kurds and Shiites reject Saddam Hussein, but some Sunnis would prefer him because they believe the current political situation deprives them of their rights.
In the well-to-do Mansour district, people come out in the evening to shop. Osama Rashid says business at his clothing store is good some days, but it drops off after a bombing because people are afraid to leave home.
Security is better than 2, 3, or 4 years ago, but we hope it will improve even more.
Some residents of this still vibrant city despair of ever seeing a return to normal life. Others remain hopeful. Many say they are living day to day. Scott Bob, VOA News, Baghdad.
Syria's government and rebels have accused each other of carrying out an apparent chemical attack in which about 25 people were killed in a town near the northern city of Aleppo. The Syrian government said a rocket struck Khan al-Asal today, sending poisonous gases into the air and killing 25 people. It said rebels fired the rocket from Aleppo's opposition-held Nayarab district. Rebels denied firing the missile and blamed it on forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The rebel-affiliated Aleppo Media Center also said the rocket struck the town, causing people to suffocate. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said 26 people were killed, including civilians and soldiers. There was no independent confirmation that the rocket contained a chemical warhead. If confirmed, the attack would represent the first use of chemical weapons since the start of a 2-year-long rebellion against President Assad's autocratic rule. The opposition Syrian National Coalition has chosen American-educated former businessman Ghassan Hito as provisional prime minister to administer the area seized by rebels from the forces of President Bashar al-Assad. Hito received 35 of the 48 votes cast by members of the opposition coalition meeting in Turkey. Hisham Marwa of the Syrian National Coalition.
So according to the bylaws, the constitution of the coalition, National Coalition for Syrian Opposition, Mr. Hito is the new prime minister of the temporary government.
Hito has lived in the United States for decades, but recently moved from Texas to Turkey to help coordinate aid to rebel-held areas. More than 100 countries have recognized the opposition coalition as the legitimate representative of the Syrian people, including the United States, Britain, France, and Turkey. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the Obama administration does not oppose moves by the United Kingdom and France to arm opponents of embattled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns has that story.
The United States already cooperates with Arab allies arming the Syrian opposition, so Secretary of State John Kerry says Washington has no objection to Europeans doing the same.
President Obama has made it clear that the United States does not stand in the way of other countries that have made a decision to provide arms, whether it's France or Britain or others.
Kerry says there's a military imbalance in Syria, with President Bashar al-Assad receiving help from Iran, Hezbollah, and Russia. That imbalance is creating what he calls a global catastrophe of Syrian refugees fleeing to Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. But Kerry says there's no change to the U.S. position of providing only non-lethal aid to the armed opposition. As he says, the Obama administration continues to work to change President Assad's calculation.
The longer the bloodshed goes on, the greater the prospect that the institutions of the state of Syria implode. And therefore, the greater the danger is to the region and the world that chemical weapons fall into the hands of really bad actors. We do not want that to happen.
France and the United Kingdom want the European Union to lift its arms embargo on Syria, and both are considering providing weapons to the opposition unilaterally if the European Union does not. Germany and other EU members echo U.S. concerns that more weapons will only lead to more fighting. Kerry said the Obama administration is leaving the door open for President Assad to find a political solution.
If he believes he can shoot it out, Syrians and the region have a problem and the world has a problem.
Kerry leaves Tuesday as part of President Obama's trip to Israel, where the war in neighboring Syria will be high on the diplomatic agenda. It's also a trip to discuss the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, in which Australian Foreign Minister Bob Carr, who met with Kerry Monday in Washington, says American leadership is required.
I believe we're at a historic moment where there is something of a convergence produced by the thinking in Ramallah and the result of the recent Israeli election.
Following the formation of his new government, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he's extending a hand in peace to Palestinians, vowing that Israel will be ready for a historic compromise that will end the conflict with the Palestinians once and for all, with a Palestinian partner that's willing to hold negotiations in goodwill. At the State Department, Foreign Minister Carr welcomed the Prime Minister's offer. Secretary Kerry said he hopes the words become a reality. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
U.S. President Barack Obama, as we've been reporting, departs Washington today for Israel, the first stop of a four-day Mideast trip, also taking him to the West Bank and Jordan. VOA senior White House correspondent Dan Robinson reports Mr. Obama will hold talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders and will discuss Syria and Iran.
President Shimon Peres and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will greet Mr. Obama on his arrival at Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport. All three will deliver remarks. Then come bilateral talks beginning at President Peres's residence in Jerusalem and later with Prime Minister Netanyahu, followed by a joint news conference. Mr. Obama is not carrying any new peace initiative on the Israel-Palestinian conflict. That has led some commentators to describe the visit as largely symbolic. In a speech at Jerusalem's International Conference Center on Thursday, for which there was fierce public competition for tickets, he's expected to cite his record of strong support for Israel and its security. But Mr. Obama also is expected to say that breaking the stalemate in peace efforts to achieve a two-state solution is becoming even more critical amid sweeping changes in the Arab world. White House officials say that message is important, National Security Council official Ben Rhodes.
In the past, the peace processes with a variety of countries and partners in the region were between Israel and individual leaders. And as you move towards more democratic, more representative and responsive governments, Israel needs to take into account the changing dynamic and the need to reach out to public opinion across the region.
Wednesday's discussions will cover stalled peace efforts, Israeli concerns about Syria's civil war, and the threat posed to Israel by Iran's nuclear program. Dan Serwer is with the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
The president has to convince the Israelis that he's got their back, and the Israelis have to be convinced that he's for real, and therefore that they should sit on their hands and do nothing.
On Thursday, Mr. Obama goes to Ramallah in the Palestinian Authority-governed West Bank. He'll hold talks with President Mahmoud Abbas before a joint news conference and a visit to a youth center. Neil Kritz of the U.S. Institute for Peace says Mr. Obama will focus his messages to Israelis and Palestinians, making the case that peace is in their interests.
It's important for the president to convey, number one, that the U.S. is seriously committed to a two-state solution, to the existence of a state of Palestine, and that this is something, again, that needs to move forward, that both sides need to engage on, as well as conveying to publics on both sides that compromises will need to be made.
Friday, Mr. Obama visits locations that are highly important and emotional and religiously significant for Israelis and Jews, Palestinians and Christians. He will lay a wreath at the graves of Yitzhak Rabin, Israel's prime minister assassinated by a Jewish fanatic in 1995, and Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism. Mr. Obama then visits Yad Vashem, the memorial to the millions of victims of the Holocaust. He returns to the West Bank to visit the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. The president concludes his trip in Jordan, where White House officials say he will discuss Syria, refugee flows, and political and economic reforms with King Abdullah. Dan Robinson, VOA News, Jerusalem.
As we mentioned, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is expected to be a major topic of discussion this week. VOA interviewed separately Israel's ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, and the Palestine Liberation Organization's chief representative to the U.S., Mayeen Rashid Erekat. We now continue with the second part of our montage series with correspondent Meredith Buell, who addresses Mr. Oren first.
What are the prospects of reconciliation between Palestinian President Abbas and Hamas in the Gaza Strip? And how can the peace process be successful as long as there's this split between the West Bank and Gaza?
Well, it would help if the Palestinians were united. They are divided right now. And we want to create a situation where we make peace with the Palestinian Authority and the West Bank. And we hold out the possibility that someday the people of Gaza can join that peace as well and partake in the benefits of peace, which means a future for their children and their grandchildren, which I don't think the inhabitants of Gaza have right now under Hamas rule. Hamas is recognized both by the United States as well as by the UN, Russia, and the European Union as a terrorist organization. Its covenant calls not only for the destruction of Israel, but it calls for the destruction of the Jewish people worldwide. It's actually a genocidal document.
This is a Palestinian internal matter that we are very much concerned about it. And we have been trying for the last few years to put an end to the divisions between the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, between Fatah and Hamas, and, you know, to try to reach a national reconciliation. Unfortunately, things are not moving the way we want them to move, but there is a strong determination on the part of the Palestinian leadership, the PLO, to put an end to these divisions. But these divisions should not be used as a pretext for not moving forward.
How can the core issue of Jerusalem be settled in such a way that it can have the support of the Palestinians and the Israelis?
Actually, the Palestinians are the ones who proposed and continue to propose a creative solution to the issue of Jerusalem. Israel, on the contrary, continues to claim monopoly over Jerusalem, ignoring the fact that Jerusalem and its holy sites is precious to Muslims, Christians, Jews, Arabs, Israelis, and Palestinians. And if the Israelis continue with their claims that Jerusalem should be the quote-unquote the undivided, the eternal undivided capital of Israel, They may have Israel, but they will never have peace. I think the only they may have Jerusalem, but they will never have peace. The only solution for Jerusalem is for Jerusalem to be a capital for two states, one Palestinian and the other Israel.
Well, our position has been, and this is through successive Israeli governments, that Jerusalem should remain the undivided capital of Israel. It is certainly the spiritual capital of the Jewish people worldwide. But Prime Minister Netanyahu, in that same speech before the joint session of Congress, said that he believes that with creativity and fair-mindedness, that a solution to the Jerusalem issue can be found as well.
Would you be willing to discuss what that might be?
No, I don't think. I think putting the cart before the horse to say what the final status of what the final shape of the Jerusalem settlement could look like. But again, it's the Prime Minister who said that with creativity, we can find that solution.
Is time running out on the two-state solution?
Of course it is. Unfortunately, with all what the Israelis are doing on the ground, imposing the facts on the ground, the settlements, the confiscation of land, all the measures that they are taking, particularly in Jerusalem, they are racing with time to undermine and to preempt the creation of a Palestinian state.
Now, I don't think time is running out in the two-state solution. I just think it's a shame that we're losing this time when the two peoples could have two independent states living side by side, and we could get on with the business of developing our societies and providing better future for our children.
Israel's ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, and the Palestine Liberation Organization's chief representative to the U.S., Ma'in Rashid Erekat, with correspondent Meredith Buell in a special one-hour report on the president's upcoming visit to the Middle East. President Obama's trip is bringing renewed scrutiny of a cornerstone of U.S. policy in the region, the peace treaty it helped forge between Egypt and Israel more than 30 years ago. VOA correspondent Elizabeth Arrett in Cairo reports Egypt's Islamist ascendancy highlights tensions between the two countries in unusual ways.
The rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt has raised alarm about the commitment of Islamist leaders to the peace treaty with Israel. President Mohamed Morsi has pledged to honor the deal, despite the Brotherhood's long opposition to the Israeli state. Amr Darag is a senior official in the Brotherhood's political wing, the Freedom and Justice Party.
Definitely, the peace has to be based on justice, okay? But Egypt is in no position right now to get into conflicts with anybody. As a responsible political force, we respect all the commitments of the state with others, you know, whether we like it or not, you know, at the time these commitments were made.
In a sign of how unpopular the peace deal is among Egyptians, even such hedged promises draw criticism, not just from Mr. Morsi's fundamentalist rivals, but also from his secular liberal opponents, political activist Wael Khalil.
Part of the criticism to Morsi is that he's proven himself a bit too pragmatic to many of us. I mean, this is the Brotherhood who, if I say this is central to politics, this was most central thing to their politics, the question of Palestine, the question of occupation.
Khalil says the issue is central to politically active Egyptians of many stripes.
It's a passage to politicization for many of us. I was politicized on the Palestinian question. The street protests and the opposition to Mubarak started in solidarity within the uprising, the second uprising, the second intifada in 2000 and 2001 and 2.
Khalil concedes some Egyptians interchanged the ideas of anti-Zionism and prejudice toward Jews. Prior to his political rise, Mr. Morsi videotaped anti-Jewish slurs, which he now argues were comments critical of Zionism. Despite a once thriving Jewish community in Egypt, both sentiments now appear deeply ingrained. Former intelligence officer Sameh Saif El-Yazel says politicians know that all too well.
There is a card which many people play with. When you attack Israel, then you get a reputation in the street. So people, they do that in Egypt because of that.
But El-Yazel argues practicality trumps rhetoric, pointing to frequent close contact between Israel and Egypt on economic, military, and political matters.
Forget about what you see in the newspaper and what you hear on the TV. But the reality is the two countries are doing normal, just like Mubarak's time.
Like Mr. Morsi's liberal and conservative critics, Al-Yazel says little has changed with Israel since the Islamist leader came to power, nor does it appear likely much will anytime soon. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
In Lebanon, it's difficult to obtain statistics about gender-based violence and domestic abuse because of family honor and a culture of silence. According to one report by the Lebanese non-governmental organization CAFA, some 75% of Lebanese women have reported at least one incident of domestic violence. In a society that relies heavily on religious leaders for guidance, a group called Abad decided to take a novel approach to combating violence against women. Paige Kollek has their story in this report for VOA Television.
Sama El Turk lives in this one-bedroom apartment with her four daughters, her mother, and her sister. The oldest daughter is 12, the youngest, 5. Their father is absent from this picture and from their lives. They divorce when she could no longer tolerate his abuse.
He hit me for things I never did, and people used to shout in front of me, "Stop hitting her." When we called the police hotline, they told me they could not interfere. And I believe that this is a tragic mistake. They wait until the husband kills the wife or their children get hurt, until anyone interferes. We should make this generation much more aware than they are now.
That's not easy in a society that shies away from talking openly about domestic violence. Many organizations have tried to tackle the problem without success. Recently, a group called Abad solicited help from religious figures. Lebanon is a country with 17 sects. Although most Lebanese are Muslims, Maronite Christians make up about one-fifth of the population. Abad wanted to represent all of Lebanon's religions in this video for Lebanese TV, the internet, and on billboards. But in the end, the message was the same.
Violence against women is a sin. Jesus Christ denounced acts of violence against women.
Anthony Kadi is program coordinator at Abad.
Many people wait for these men to speak, to gain some sort of insight towards their lives and how they should live their lives. And so these men coming out with such a powerful, direct message about ending violence against women and how the religion stands against violence against women is so important.
Nabil Shahadi, pastor at All Saints Church in Beirut, says religious figures have more clout in the Middle East than in the West.
In the Middle East and in Lebanon, there isn't such a separation between faith and daily living. And so religious leaders have a big say in society and can be political mobilizers, not just religious leaders, and they're social mobilizers.
Human rights activists in Lebanon believe civil society campaigns like this one are having an impact, but that violence against women and domestic violence require greater attention, both from the government and law enforcement, for things to truly change. Paige Kollek for VOA News, Beirut, Lebanon.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.